Have you seen Chuck Norris lately? He's still kicking butt and staying active well into his 80s. What's even more shocking is he looks more jacked than ever and seems to have more energy than guys half his age. And it's all thanks to Morning Kick, a revolutionary new daily drink from Roundhouse Provisions that combines ultra-potent greens like spirulina and kale with probiotics, prebiotics, collagen, and even ashwagandha. Just mix with water, stir, and enjoy. Unlike other green drinks out there, this one tastes exactly like strawberry lemonade and has hundreds of five-star reviews. Go to roundhouseprovisions.com/save44 for up to 44% off your regular priced order. Plus, every purchase is backed by a 90-day money-back guarantee. So if you want to experience smoother digestion, a boost of energy, and just an overall healthier body, then go to roundhouseprovisions.com/save44 today. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. Results can vary.
And his response is naturally, as like, where else would it be?
Yep.
Welcome to Recotopia, a happy home for recommended movies, TV shows, music, video games, foodstuffs, and more from two people you can definitely trust. Trustability varies by region, no guarantees implied. And now, here are your hosts, Chris Atkinson and Aaron Dicer.
I had to see you once, speak my piece. I was getting out because I love you. I couldn't bear seeing you and him together.
Oh, you love me. Why didn't you tell me before?
Hello, everybody. It's Recotopia episode 131, which sounds like a lot. I'm Chris Atkinson, joined by Aaron Dicer.
Heidely ho, Notori Renos.
There you go. Yes, today's big recommend is Alfred Hitchcock's Notorious from 1946. Once again, we'd like to welcome chat who have come out here to watch us talk about movies on a Tuesday. Aaron, would you like to start us off with our small recommends?
It's no big deal.
Itty bitty living space.
It's so small and light.
It's small, it's tiny, it's petite, it's wee.
Sure thing, Big Daddy. I have no idea why that just happened, and I apologize to everyone involved. I will leave the suspense in, or the chat in suspense no longer. The question was asked, and now it will be answered. Yes, I am small recommending Beetlejuice, which I got a chance to see recently and really enjoyed. Mm-hmm. I think much of this will depend on your feelings about Tim Burton in general. You know, if you like the way he takes, you know, the macabre and turns it into, whimsy, then I think you're going to really love this. If you love the original Beetlejuice, this is more of the same. And I think it's a real trick to take a property like this for 40 years. Is it almost four decades later?
Yeah, almost. Yeah, it's like 36.
I mean, yep. and to bring it back with the original people like this, I mean, all those that were available, and then add some new elements to it, but make it kind of feel like the same thing is going on. Keaton is so much fun in this role. I have so much fun every time he's on screen. It just works. And I laughed a lot and had a good time. And sometimes that's why you go to the movies. So yeah,
that's true. Stuff. I watched this a couple of days ago.
Oh, nice.
I pretty much enjoyed myself.
Okay.
There are several moments in this that I'm like, that's truly inspired. I love what they did with this. This is like classic Tim Burton Tim Burton feels like he's getting back to his old roots on this, and it doesn't feel like a total cash grab, even though to be cynical, it is to start with.
Almost then, by definition, right? Like, I mean, right, you know, yeah.
Yeah. The two things actually about this movie that really drag it down for me, maybe three things. One is the relationship Jenna Ortega has with the guy that she meets in this movie. I feel like that was very underdeveloped, and they don't treat it with any respect whatsoever. the Monica Bellucci character, who I really like, but just I feel like they just left her kind of hanging too in this. And then there is that interminable Manchester Park song going on for like 5 minutes, and it doesn't need to. And so like those were the things that dragged it down for me. But there are enough in here that if you didn't small recommend it, I might have small recommended it. That's where we're at on this one. I don't like it as much as you did, but I did enjoy. There were like some very inspired things in this.
Yeah, there's only one of the points you make I would slightly disagree with, which is I thought the song going on forever was glorious. I thought it was kind of one of those things where it just kept getting funnier and funnier to me. Mm. And I guess I was just in. But I can see, especially if you're like, okay, enough, it's going to go on for a lot longer. And so that okay enough probably does elevate quite a bit during that. But yeah, I agree with the other things. I think there is an underdevelopment of the antagonists in this movie in general. And, you know, maybe at the end of the day, Tim Burton just wasn't interested in that. He was just more interested in more of the plot mechanics rather than the antagonist protagonist, you know, dynamic. I don't know.
All right. Well, over the weekend, I had another movie night with my friends, and it was my turn to pick. So I picked two movies. One of them I can recommend. One I don't think I can. I will tell you that the one I can't recommend is Life Force. I can't in good conscience recommend that movie, but I do recommend it on the down low a little bit if you want to see something just, you know, out there. But anyway, I was in the mood for some 80s schlock, and so I picked two movies I'd never seen before. One was Life Force. The other one was 1987's The Hidden, which stars Kyle MacLachlan as this FBI agent who acts a bit off. He's a little bit weird. Why is that?
There's Kyle MacLachlan acts a little bit weird?
I know. What the hell, man? This is so beyond type. Anyway, so there's a guy at the beginning of this movie who's going on a crime spree. He's driving the sports car while playing dirty, dirty rock music at the same time. And he's killing people, all this stuff. And then, like he gets into a wreck. He goes to a hospital, and then Kyle MacLachlan shows up to the police station. And the main policeman here, the main detective here, is played by Michael Nouri. Kyle MacLachlan's like, I'm looking for this guy. And I need to know where he is. And he's like, well, he's at the hospital. Well, the guy who's in the hospital has a thing inside of him that he delivers to his roommate at the hospital. And now the roommate has this black alien creature inside of him. And he gets out of the hospital and he starts going on a crime spree. So it's very hard to figure out where this alien is at any time or whatever. So it's basically just sort of Kyle MacLachlan and Michael Nouri chasing after whoever this alien is. It kind of reminded me of Fallen, the later Fallen that came out, where, you know, the demon is going to different people and everything. But this one, it has so many fun 80s, you know, schlock elements to it. You're going to laugh throughout this movie. It's kind of serious, but not really, never really is serious and everything. And it's a very simple story, very fun to watch. I highly recommend The Hidden if you haven't heard of it before.
I saw this as a surprise screening at the Austin Film Festival that I went to a few years ago. That's a fantastic fest. They do like surprise screenings or whatever. And is it Jack Shoulder maybe or something like that?
Yep.
He was there and afterwards sat for like some questions and told stories. And he was what I remember. First of all, the movie is wild and worth a watch because it's just really fun to watch. But I remember Jack Shoulder being one of those guys who's like not in the industry necessarily anymore. And so he like doesn't care. And he's just telling stories out of school. It was just kind of one of those fun things. But yeah, this is like an old genre, you know, kind of sci-fi classic. So, yeah. Yeah, that's fun.
Oh, there's nothing better than finding someone who don't give a fuck no more, because they will tell you the stories. They're ready to spill the tea, man. Because, you know, they don't have to worry about the, oh, no, they're going to get, what are you going to do to my career now? I don't have one anyway.
Yeah, exactly. Mm. My second small recommend, I've been wanting to get around to seeing this. It is an adaptation of a Broadway musical that they filmed kind of, I call Hamilton style. I know others have done it where it's like they're filming the Broadway show, but they're also doing extra shots where, you know, they're doing, you know, cameras that are on stage and, you know, those kind of things. But this is Sarah Bareilles in Waitress the Musical. Okay, first I'll just say, if you don't like musicals, just stay away. You're not going to enjoy this. It is a very, very typical Broadway musical, people breaking out in Broadway musical numbers kind of thing. I love that stuff. So that stuff is a bonus for me. The real draw here, and the reason I make it a small recommend, is I think Sarah Bareilles is one of the most talented vocalists living right now. I think she's incredible. And she does some vocal things in some of these songs that just blew me away. There's one of these songs, I forget what it's called, I apologize, but I think it's had a little bit more of mainstream exposure. You know, she's messy, but she's kind, is one of the lyrics. Anyways, and I, when that popped on, I was like, oh, I kind of know this song already, even though I've never, you know, seen this musical. As far as the story goes, pretty basic, like in a bad marriage, looking for something different kind of storyline that you've seen before. But it's also putting an emphasis on not sugarcoating that. So in other words, when a character makes you know, a bad choice, let's say to have an affair or something, the musical doesn't sugarcoat that. It makes a statement about everyone in this being human and making human choices, and that those have, you know, positive and negative consequences, and have positive and negative moral implications for the characters. I found it really interesting and worth a watch, and yeah, I would recommend it. I think it's available VOD if you want to check it out. Waitress the Musical.
Have you ever seen the movie that this is based on?
I haven't, but now I kind of want to, because I'm sure
Carrie
it's a very
Russell.
I'm sure it's a very similar storyline, and I think Sarah Bareilles saw the movie and was inspired by it enough that she was like, I like the messiness of this. I want to create a musical about it.
Well, the writer of Waitress, Adrienne Shelley, was an actress who she wrote Waitress, and I believe she was in the movie as well. But she tragically got killed by a worker in her building one day or something like that. I don't know if she even got to – I don't know if she got to see the premiere of this movie when it came out. But this really interests me now that I realize that it's based on that. And I want to see what they've done with the material to make it, you know, turn it into a musical and everything. So I'm very interested in this. The movie is good too. It's got Nathan Fillion in it. It's
oh nice.
Yeah, it's fun.
I will add that to my watch list.
Yeah. It had been a while since I had seen this movie. It's it's like when there's movies that are so good and you haven't seen them in decades. You can count decades probably since you've seen them. It's like, maybe it's time to watch this. After all, I do have a Blu-ray of it, and it is sitting right there for me to watch. Why can't I just go ahead and watch it? That movie was Thief from 1981, Michael Mann, in probably, I don't know, this might be his first big feature. I think I looked it up, and it seemed like he had just done a lot of shorts and maybe some like very unknown type of movies before that or whatever. But this is so good. Michael Mann may be one of the people like who was responsible for how how 80s entertainment went. And Tangerine Dream, the composer in this, also hugely influential to how the 80s, like Thief, and even in 1981, you're like, whoa. It's amazing how 80s this movie is, and we barely gotten into the 80s at this point. But this is about James Caan, who is the titular thief in the movie. He is a jewel thief. We see him at the very beginning stealing a bunch of jewels, and then he wants to sell them. He's supposed to get $185,000 off of the jewels that he got. His guy, his like middleman, wants to do something, wants to get James Caan into like something on the street. Like if you invest basically with these other bad guys, you can make a lot more money. And James Caan is not about that. He's the lone man in this. Well, the guy he sends off to sell the stuff gets killed, and then he goes off to confront the people who killed that guy and stole his money, and then he eventually gets the money back from this group of gangsters led by Robert Prosky. And Robert Prosky says he wants James Caan to work for him. Hey, look, how much money can we make together? It'd be so good and everything. And James Caan's like, no, I don't want to do that. But James Caan's got he's got a life he wants to live, man. He wants to see this girl that he sees at this diner, played by Tuesday Weld. He wants to marry her. He's got a postcard or like a collage postcard thing that shows his entire life. And the only thing that's missing is a wife and kids. And then he can just go ahead and walk off into the sunset. But he didn't have enough money. He finally has to sort of break some of his rules to finally get enough money to support a wife and a kid and all that. So he breaks down and he wants to work for Robert Prosky. And of course, Robert Prosky isn't just like, hey, do a job or two or whatever, and then you're okay. He's not that type of dude. So there's like a conflict here between not only Prosky, but the cops and everything. And this, but of any heist film, the biggest thrills that you're going to get out of it is seeing a professional be a professional and like figuring out, okay, we know all of this. We know what we're going to do with this problem when we rob this place. These four alarms. Well, there's a fifth alarm that he needs to figure out. So like he needs to figure out, how do we get past this fifth alarm? And then the safe itself is built of some sort of material that they've never seen before. You know, how do we get into the safe? So it's stuff like that that really gets the blood pumping. And like when they finally start doing the heist and everything, it's really cool. Anyway, this is a great, great movie I was finally glad to revisit after all this time.
Watched this for the first time within the last couple of years and loved it. Loved it. Mm-hmm. Like it's just a great front to back, keep your attention, tell a simple story kind of movie. And I don't mean that the tension in the narrative isn't complex, because it does get complex. I just mean, I think now we're used to when's the big story twist coming, and that was a tricky thing the story did there. And I think this movie is a testament to, you know what, just tell a really good story really well and make the drama character based and let us be invested in the human beings. And man, we're along for the ride. And I thought this was really, really good.
Yeah.
It's a good recommend.
Yeah. All right. On to our big recommend, which is Notorious from 1946. And Aaron, this is yours, so take it away.
I'm fine. It's just that you're so big.
It's so huge.
It's a good rule, but this is bigger than rules.
It's bigger on the inside.
Is it?
I noticed.
Notorious, a 1946 film noir spy thriller directed by Alfred Hitchcock. It was his 36th movie overall and his 10th film since he abandoned England to make films in sunny Southern California. After a minute of opening credits, possibly the absolutely most complex, fully spelled out way to indicate time, date, and place on the screen, we follow some reporters to their place just outside of a district courtroom. In court, John Huberman is convicted of treason and sentenced to prison for 20 years. The reporters then accost the criminal's daughter with just enough exposition to get us some foundational knowledge. We cut to a party where there's dancing and drinking in the back of a shadowed figure who has crashed this party. After some veiled conversation relating the art of fishing to sexual conquest, we lift the veil on the guest who is none other than Hitchcock's favorite actor, part one, the pre-Jimmy days, Cary Grant, playing Devlin, a playboy who's about to take a drunk drive with Hitchcock's favorite actress, part one, the pre-Grace days, Ingrid Bergman. After a policeman rightfully stops them, he then unrightfully lets them go after Cary Grant shows off some ID. She gets angry that he's apparently a cop, too, and he promptly either knocks her out or watches her pass out. I'm not quite sure, but then he goes home and puts her to bed, but not in the way we were all probably thinking the evening was going. Once she comes to, he tells her that he wants her to help by going to spy in Brazil for the police. He appeals to her patriotism, but she denies being a patriot before he reveals he brought receipts, and they spin at about 45 rotations per minute, playing a conversation proving that she's loved America enough not only to not to go along with her German father. She finally agrees to go with this handsome new agent. On the plane ride over to Rio, we casually find out that her dad popped a poison pill and died the previous day. They then arrive in Rio as confirmed by Jesus hanging out just outside her plane window, as he is wont to do. After some more crackling dialogue started at a cafe and ended on a mountain they apparently climbed somehow, we get the sense that she just wants to be trusted and he may be falling for her, despite his distrust of her body count. But their love is confirmed as he forcefully smashes his face against hers. A quick trip to a boardroom confirms that the guys in suits have some plans. Dev and Alicia then retire to the beautiful deck at her hotel room for some of the sexiest icebox chicken conversation that side of the Hays Code. Unfortunately, the finger-licking good experience is cut short as Devlin has to go get his assignment, which turns out to be a honeypot mission for his new gal. They want her to flirt her way into a guy named Sebastian's home to find out what they're up to. Devlin is immediately possessive about his one-day unconsummated crush, but goes back and lets her know the gig anyway. She throws a few jabs and fishes for some compliments, but Cary Grant continues to play Devlin's advocate extremely coldly so that she can commit to the job. Then it's off to woo Sebastian. One horse ride later and the job is done. Sebastian, played by Claude Rains, is on the hook. A dinner date proves that Alicia is great at this, and a second date is set for a dinner party at his home where she is supposed to memorize everyone's names and nationalities without asking any questions. She noticed that one of them feels a little bit nervous about a bottle of wine, and we notice that Emil then is offered a ride home, which is probably a sign that he's never actually making it home. Later at the races, Alicia meets with Devlin, and after saying she's done the thing she was sent there to do, Devlin gets cold again. They're then interrupted by Sebastian, who's apparently been spying on them, watching them across the track, and needs her to go back to his house and prove that she loves him more. Alicia now calls a meeting because Sebastian has proposed marriage, and Devlin gives the emotionally loaded green light. After the honeymoon, Alicia quickly discovers that the wine cellar door is locked and becomes suspicious. She asks for her keys, but the key to the wine cellar is the only one she isn't given. Devlin then suggests that, well, maybe they throw a party to get that key and have him invited under the cover of proving she isn't interested. He agrees and then she steals it with some sneaky sleight of hand and foot. The party begins with a stunning zoom from all the way up the stairs to a tight close-up of Alicia's hand holding the key like 50 feet away. She hands the key off to Devlin before they interrupt a man grabbing a glass of champagne, probably in celebration of that show-off stair zoom shot that he just pulled off. After leaving Sebastian under the auspices of asking the orchestra to play some more Brazilian music, she takes Devlin to the wine cellar to snoop around. His clumsiness knocks over a wine bottle that is apparently full of some black sand, soon to be known to the world as uranium. And we watch the champagne bottles disappear one by one upstairs. We know that they're about to get caught. They do somehow manage to get it all cleaned up and just outside the door just in time before being caught, and then trying to sell a story that he pushed himself on her and then she pushed him away and convinced him it was over. This ruse works until Sebastian realizes that his key was missing. After it magically reappears in the morning, he does some hunting, and as proof as to the importance and value of chronologically organizing your physical media, I mean wine bottles, he finds glass shards that prove shenanigans happened in the wine cellar. Sebastian immediately says, "I'm telling my mom," and she says she knew all along, bet that they can take care of this internally without letting anyone else know. Alicia now starts to not feel so well, and after an intense meeting where a guest is very dramatically warned not to accidentally drink her coffee, she puts two and two together and realizes she's being poisoned. She collapses and is taken to her room by the Nazi mother-son duo, who promised to get a doctor to treat her, but we know she's likely not long for this world. Meanwhile, Devlin is starting to think that, well, maybe she's not actually just a raging alcoholic and needs to get over there to see what's going on. He heads to the mansion where he finds his way up to her room and realizes he now basically needs to carry her down that same set of stairs that Hitchcock so expertly showed us the distance of earlier. They're intercepted by Sebastian, fresh from a Nazi boys' night, and his mom, who find them in the peculiar situation now of not wanting to give anything away for their own safety with the other Nazi guys in the house. This gets Devlin and Alicia to the door, but as Sebastian begs to be taken away with them, Devlin says, "Not my circus, not my monkeys," and we follow Sebastian back inside his home to what will surely be a welcoming group of friends supportive of him in his trauma and there to help in any way possible. Mm. And that is Notorious. Chris, mm-hmm. what did you think this time through?
First off, a shout out to Nick, who says the mom felt like they were gaslighting her, so she decided to give Bergman vertigo. There you go.
Uh-huh.
Nice. All right. So I love this movie, of course. This is a great one. And Hitchcock, you know, there's very few that I've ever watched that I'm like, that wasn't very good. Or, there's probably a ton that I have not seen that are like, oh, yeah, that's the reason why. You never hear about that one, but this is good stuff. So I love the part where Devlin learns about Alicia's mission and he gives all the reasons why she shouldn't do it without giving away that he's in love with her to his boss and everything. And so he's giving every reason basically why she shouldn't, while not, you know, being able to say, you know, I'm in love with her. I don't want her to go with some other dude. And then he tells Alicia about her assignment and he has to withhold all those reasons he gave to his boss to pretend he's just being, because he's just being a professional while also hoping she turns down the assignment on her own and not give away that he's in love with her. So that there's a, I love that dynamic that happens within 5 to 10 minutes of each other, him having to be one way with his boss and then being another way with her later. Devlin and Alicia's relationship in the hands of Grant and Bergman is, of course, very believable. So I love that no matter how professional they think they're being, it's palpable to others how much they love each other. And she has to lie so many times to Sebastian, and that's the reason why he ramps up this marriage right off the bat because he never really believes it the entire time, but he wants to so badly that he's like, let's ramp up the stakes and then she can prove it to me by marrying me after a week and everything like that. And his delusion is a believable character flaw for this movie, which, you know, a lot of times we see, in modern day movies, it feels like the villain's flaw is just, oh, he's dumb or he's megalomaniacal and he can't see the things that are going to trip him up and everything like that. I love that there's an actual like reason here. I don't know how prevalent spy movies were by the time 1946 rolls around. So I don't know how prevalent scenes were where the spy has to do something that is perceived as negative just so they can keep their cover. And then when Devlin goes in to kiss Alicia down at the wine cellar and everything, he's like, he wants Sebastian to know. He wants Sebastian to say, oh, they were just down here, fooling around or whatever. And I love that scene, especially when you consider the year that this, how many scenes like that had happened at this point? I would assume not many, but maybe that was old hat even back in 1946 for all I know. I don't know. Yeah, and I like how Sebastian isn't dumb, but his judgment is clouded by his obsession. So when he finally sets his obsession aside, the scenes where he's figuring out things on his own are great, and he's finding the difference between the years on the bottles, finding the broken bottle underneath the rack, placing his keys on the table that don't have the cellar key on it, and then checking to see if it's on the ring the next day. Love all that stuff. We talked a lot about the Hays Code last week, and to get a sort of a refresher on this, it was sort of a morals code, no sex, nudity, strong language, the bad guy had to pay for the crimes in the end, all these different things. And in this movie, they're skirting Hays Code stuff left and right, especially during the kissing scene, which a lot of people talk about, that you could not kiss on screen for longer than 3 seconds. That was a part of the Hays Code. So what does Hitchcock do? He puts them in a situation where for a minute and a half, they kiss each other for about 3 seconds, and then they start talking about things. But the camera stays in close, and they stay in close. And then they kiss each other for another 3 seconds, and then they talk about stuff again. And Hitchcock, this is the reason why we sort of, like, love Hitchcock, because he was always like, here, okay, tell me what the rules are. All right, now I'm going to kind of toe the line, and I'm actually going to step on the line, and let's see what happens with this. And so that scene is masterful in so many ways, and it's still... This is another thing about the Hays Code. A lot of things came off better because of it, because there's something they can't do in these movies, and they're still kind of getting away with it, but there's like a rule. There's like something like, ooh, thrilling. They're getting away with something, but they're also showing restraint. So at the same time, that scene with Cary Grant and Ingrid Bergman where they're kissing each other is like hot, right? It's just super hot. In the end, the other little Hays Code shenanigans they do in this that I love is the way she reveals that she's had sex with Sebastian. You can add Alex to my list of playmates. and it's like, I imagine Hays Code enforcers were sitting there going, God, that's so blatant, but they don't come out and say it. So what are we going to do? Like, you know, they wanted to do something about it and they just couldn't. So I love that too. Okay. So one thing I don't like about this movie, and it's minor in the grand scheme of things, but I kind of hate the villains, and not, I don't mean just because they're bad guys. We have one guy who unnecessarily freaks out at a bottle of wine, and then he ends up getting killed over it. And I understand why they kill him, but it's like, do you really think that they're serving uranium at the dinner? Is that why you're so, like, you're so upset about this? You really think that you didn't know that there were some bottles that actually have wine in them that they serve occasionally? How else do you think they put the uranium in there? They dumping the wine out and everything? I don't know what that's all about. And then the ending is a little weak because of this too, because they suspect Sebastian of doing something they need to kill him over because his wife is ill and it doesn't seem believable. That's what it comes down to. It just doesn't. I wish that it was a little bit more than that. And so, like, that's one thing about this. The movie doesn't need to have, like, hardcore strong villains to work, because it's not really about that. But at the same time, like, the danger that they sort of represent doesn't make much sense. Like, they must be the most intuitive villains ever created if they just believe, oh, she's ill, and because of these circumstances, it must mean that she knows about the plot that they're doing or whatever. And by the way, just don't have uranium in your wine cellar. What is that all about? anyway, that's my ultimate beef with that part of the movie. And one last thing. I know you're going to say something about that, sure. But one last thing. And I love you mentioned the great camera shot from the stairwell. The other shot I love is when she wakes up after being drunk and Cary Grant is walking over to her and the camera is upside down and turns and everything. I love that one too. Anyway, go ahead.
Yeah. Also throw in, since we're talking great camera shots, the dual focus shot with the coffee cup and her, even though it looks like they're, you know, she's, a distance from the cup, they actually created a forced perspective giant coffee cup, so both things could be in focus. I just, mm-hmm. Hitchcock, I just love the, mm-hmm. his problem solving, right? Like, he's a great problem solver, and it goes back to the Hays Code thing. Like, here's what I want to do. I will find a way to do it. Yeah. I guess I'll start by just quickly responding to the villain problem, which I don't think you're completely off on. I think the your first point for me is the strongest, which is, that guy's quite an idiot to be in this inner circle of you know, these guys. Like, he's he's clearly just so supposed to be the incompetent one that they need to get rid of, and because he doesn't understand how to, you know, calmly approach any questions he might have or not freak out at things. You know, that doesn't kind of fall in line with the rest of them. I do think the movie does lay the groundwork that these guys know they're being closed in on, and they're trying to figure out how. Now, putting that together with it being, you know, Sebastian's fault because his wife was an agent, I guess that's up for grabs if it doesn't work or it does. I think there's enough for them to be suspicious. My feeling is that they're about to have a talk, and it's about to get really obvious. Because we, towards the end of the movie, from both sides, from both the agent side and their side, there are separate conversations about, you know, it feels like something's coming to a head, like they're on to us, or, you know, this will be over tomorrow, I think they say on the agent's, you know, side. Mm-hmm. So we were clearly, you know, at the end of, you know, whatever this exploration is.
But happening. I see that, but like, she's sick and they need to take her to the hospital, and that's how they're gonna figure everything out from that. I don't know. I don't think it's the illness.
I just think it's Devlin and her leaving. You know, like, I just, you know.
But what do they figure out from Devlin and her leaving? What does that mean? Do they know Devlin?
I don't know, but I would assume that the idea is like, who is this obvious American guy coming in to take your wife away, you know, and why did you let him leave with her? I don't know. There's some questions to be asked, I guess, but but I think it's valid. I don't think it's completely stretching it all the way out to
make it make sense. Okay, yes, gotcha. Yeah, gotcha.
There we go. Some other things that I want to talk about. This part, the female lead in this was originally a sex worker, which I think is another interesting part of Hitchcock taking the story and trying to adapt it into the Hays Code, because really one of the overarching themes in this movie is about his distrust of her because of her promiscuous past. The idea is you've been with, it's a body count movie, right? You've been with so many people that, you know, am I supposed to trust you now that you'll only be with me or whatever? Mm-hmm. And the way, like the playmate thing, the way those things are phrased, you know, the idea that this movie is about, you know, your past and how you reckon with that and can you change, is really expertly done when you think of the original, you know, had that as, you know, a sex worker and making that obvious. The uranium stuff blows my mind in 1946, like how far ahead of the curve that was. In fact, they almost banned this movie because uranium wasn't well known to be a radioactive material or used in the process.
Right.
And there, you know, there was somebody who was in on like atom bomb conversations that they talked to, and like, I can't tell you how to make an atomic bomb, but I can tell you uranium is, you know, part of the process. And so they were like, okay, we'll do uranium. I thought that was wild in 1946.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Love so much the dialogue in this, much of which was improvised, by the way, on that balcony stuff was improvised. But there's lines that stood out to me this time that I'd never heard before. One is when they're leaving the party early on in the movie, and she says, my car's outside. And his response is, naturally, as like, where else would it be?
Yep.
It was so well delivered. I loved that. Same scene. He says, don't you need a coat? And she says, you'll do.
Yes.
Amazing. And then there are other times where it's just these asides that I don't know. I think Hitch had a really interesting sense of humor. It's, you know, it's very British, very dry a lot of times, but there's this moment where they're talking, just as an aside about going to the movies, and somebody says, Eric loves to go to the movies to cry. Very sentimental, you know, that Eric. So I just thought that was funny. Dry your eyes, baby. It's out of character was another line that stood out to me this time. It's a great delivery there. I think those comments about my wife were uncalled for is such an interesting, like, because it's all under the surface, but then it's like everybody knows, you know, what's being talked about. I thought that was good. I think there's an interesting thing this movie I noticed this time is doing with distance shots from the reverse. So when we first start, or even just shots from the reverse, because when we first start the courtroom, we're outside the courtroom looking through at the back of, you know, this person that's being put away, and we never see them. Then we cut to the party, and again, Cary Grant mm-hmm. is shadowed. It's just his back we see forever. And then the final shot of the movie is Claude Rains. Again, it's his courtroom. It's a different kind of courtroom, but it's from a distance from the back. And there's also an interesting thing. Like, he has to ascend the stairs to hell, basically, mm-hmm. after they descended the stairs to heaven. You know what I mean? Like, there's kind of this interesting, I'm probably adding a lot of that, but I just, you know, when I watch Hitchcock movies, he plays with these motifs in such interesting ways that I think it allows you to kind of see some deep things there. The thing Hitchcock has with moms in his movie, it's never ending. Like, Psycho is mm-hmm. probably the biggest example. You know, of his mom issues, mm-hmm. but they're here too. This, you know, Nazi villain guy is just completely mom dominated, you know, for this movie. So, I found that interesting as well. One final thing, this is just kind of a final thought that I thought was interesting. At the beginning, they cut to, it's either the party or after that, cutting to them getting together to talk about the plan. But there's a guy that looks a lot like Hitchcock that just walks mm-hmm. across the street, and I swear Hitchcock is you know, doing a fake out cameo at that point, which I just think is so interesting that he's like playing with this thing, you know, that early on.
He is the one at the party getting the drinks, and then he walks off screen, right? Yeah.
Yeah, he grabs a glass of champagne right before they come in. I always have so much fun with this movie. I just think it's so well written, well performed, and you know, they were his two go-tos before Jimmy Stewart and Grace Kelly. Like, you know, Ingrid Bergman was in two of his movies, Cary Grant was in several of his movies, in fact, he and Ingrid famously got along so well that his wife was uncomfortable with it. she was not happy that they kept doing movies together, because there was something there that, like, he mm-hmm. let her like add stuff to scenes, which famously Hitchcock never did. So mm-hmm. that's kind of an interesting thing, but. Yeah. Anyways,
I do think Hitchcock fell in love with his stars a lot.
So
like, I don't know if anything actually happened, but like, Ingrid Bergman is, of course, an all timer for me. Grace Kelly is like a incredible all timer. Like, you cannot tear your eyes away from Grace Kelly. And of course, he notoriously had a thing for blondes all the way throughout. So like, mm-hmm. it's like, okay, I'm not doing Ingrid Bergman anymore. We're doing Grace Kelly. No, I can't do Grace Kelly anymore. Let's do Tippi Hedren. Mm-hmm. So it's like, it's just he kept on doing that over and over. But yeah, that is an interesting thing. I did not realize that she was allowed to do all of those type of things on his movies.
Yeah, there's some trivia about the wine bottle scene. There's some trivia about mm-hmm. the wine bottle scene that she actually changed some of the lines and asked for some different things, and he went along with it, which is wild because, again, his reputation is famously nothing changes. He was a perfectionist about this is what the camera sees, this is how it sees it, here, you know, what needs to happen. So, interesting stuff.
Yeah. All right. Well, I guess we'll go on to the super secret double feature.
So just like you, I like to save money, and that's why when Mint Mobile came over to our little corner of the internet, I started to pay attention. And let me tell you, something interesting happened. I realized that I think I have an unhealthy relationship with my existing provider. I had to do this thing where it's like, should I try something new? No, I've been with this provider for so long. And then I got to looking at my bill and I thought, do I really want to keep spending this much money when it appears that Mint Mobile can do the exact same for $15 a month? And that's when I started to click around and find out. To get started, I did just what you can do. Go to mintmobile.com/recotopia. And then right there is where I saw the 3-month plans that were like $15 a month. And that includes the unlimited plan. All of the plans come with high-speed data and unlimited talk and text, and they deliver all that on the nation's largest 5G network, which is great. Even better, you can use your own phone number. And I'm kind of, you know, connected emotionally to my phone number. Another thing I probably should dig into in therapy. So to get this new customer offer and your new 3-month premium wireless plan for just $15 a month, go to mintmobile.com/recotopia. That's mintmobile.com/recotopia. You can cut your wireless bill to $15 a month at mintmobile.com/recotopia. There is a $45 upfront payment required that's equivalent to $15 a month. New customers on first 3-month plan only. Speeds slower above 40 gigabytes on unlimited plan. And additional taxes, fees, and restrictions apply. See Mint Mobile for details.
Be very, very quiet.
Secret? What secret?
Our dirty little secret.
I tell you something I've never told anyone.
I went through a couple on this one, and I even made our resident graphics designer here, Aaron, go through a whole thing for one and changed it. But the first one I thought of as an easy one was North by Northwest, because there's a lot of similarities in that movie. Mm-hmm. Where you have someone who is, you know, basically decorated as an amateur spy in the movie. You know, Cary Grant is mistaken for a spy in North by Northwest, and of course he has a love affair with someone who is on the bad side or whatever, and these type of elements happen in this. The next one I thought about was Jackie Brown, but I was unsure, and this is the one that I had him make a graphic for at first. Jackie Brown, I wasn't sure if we had used Jackie Brown as a super secret double feature before. And in fact, I suspect that we've used it at least once, maybe twice before. And I was like, man, I don't know. I like Jackie Brown as a double feature, but I ultimately have decided that the super secret double feature of this movie should be Moulin Rouge for a lot of the romantic parts of this. The main thing about Moulin Rouge is that Nicole Kidman is playing this dancer and this courtesan, and like she's supposed to go to the guy who can pay the most, basically. And so Ewan McGregor shows up in her life, and she mistakes him for this wealthy person, and they fall in love. And before she finds out that he's not the wealthy person, and then the wealthy person comes into her life, and she's supposed to be with him, but she's fallen in love with Ewan McGregor. And if you want to talk about a whole thing made up for a love affair, they make up an entire musical so that they can have this love affair in Moulin Rouge. She's seeing him secretly, but then pretending to be in love with the Richard Roxburgh character all the way, the Duke, all the way through that movie. And I feel like the parallels are pretty good on Moulin Rouge. Now, stylistically, Notorious and Moulin Rouge could not be farther apart. Moulin Rouge is one of those, it's a Baz Luhrmann movie, so it's like all over the place, hyper-edited, super colorful, blah, blah, blah. And it does not, it, like watching those two movies back to back, you cannot get bigger whiplash. But I think story wise, they are very, very close.
Yeah, no, I think that's a great choice. There's a real similar feel to the character Nicole Kidman is playing, and the character Ingrid Bergman is playing. You know, there's a demureness to it despite its sensuality, you know, and that's not easy to pull off. So
yeah. All right, well, it's gonna be my turn for next week's homework, and again, kind of a culmination of things after I watched these two 80s movies over the weekend, and this podcast has been recommending John Carpenter movies quite a bit. So we're going to do They Live from 1988. That is going to be our big recommend. Aaron, have you ever seen They Live?
I have, and rewatched it recently because it'd been a while. I'm excited to dig in. This movie is wild.
Yeah, it is wild. It's super wild. I can't wait to get into this one. I've seen this movie multiple times, and I'm glad to sort of like introduce this to our audience who have mm-hmm. not seen it before. And really, honestly, John Carpenter's nearly entire filmography could get onto this program, especially from the years of 1974 all the way mm-hmm. to 1990 or so. So looking forward to getting into that again. All right, looks like we have some time for some questions.
Question.
I got something to say.
I want the truth.
I'm listening.
Let's see what we got in the old question bag. What film detail did it take you five or more viewings to notice / comprehend?
I love the five or more viewings. Like that's like a specific. I'm like, do I have to go back?
It's
and
like the
count
villain
in my mind.
It's like the villain who's like, you have 72 hours. Why? Why is it 72 hours anyway?
I know I have had watched Bad Times at the El Royale at least five times and was still picking up new stuff. And it was kind of one of those progressive things where I would find a theme or something that Drew Goddard was playing with, and then the next time I watch it, I realize how it's there the whole time. One of the most recent is the idea of 50-50 choices in that movie, or 50-50 splits, which is clearly there with the location of the hotel being you know, on a dividing line. The hotel is divided, who's on which side, all those kind of things. But then there's also these subtle things that happen, you know, through the whole movie. There's a coin flip at the beginning. At the end, Lewis Pullman's face, when we learn about his past and all that and what he's doing at the end, is almost exactly half covered, just covered in blood, and half clean and pristine. And it's this duality that he's been playing with the entire movie, and that character represents with, you know, this timid guy that's been timid through the whole movie that you find out at the end is more than you realized, and is, you know, half a killer and half an angel. I don't know. I just, that movie, every time I watch it, I find new stuff in it. I think it's really, really smart. So
I've seen this movie a couple of times. I haven't seen it as much as you and Jeremy have seen it. Jeremy's probably watched this 20 times by now. He probably watches it every day since he's been on vacation. But that's great. I haven't noticed that on my viewings. I didn't notice those 50-50 things yet. But that's an awesome thing to catch. It also reminds me of the, you know, where he's like, the guy was lying in bed with a wolf. It wasn't sexual. It wasn't not sexual.
Yes. Yep.
Mine is, I feel like I'm shameful on this one because it was in Knives Out, and it's how they keep calling Ana de Armas's character either Colombian or Mexican, or they change the nationality every single time. I didn't notice it the first time, didn't notice it the second time, didn't notice it the third time, and then watched it. I think I got the Blu-ray and decided to watch it, and I was like, oh, they keep changing the nationalities of her, and it's perfectly in line with what he's doing with that movie too. I felt really bad that I never caught that. And since I'm, you know, we're almost out of the original set of, we've got a whole brand new set of questions, but since we're close to the end of that original set that Jeremy answered, go ahead and give Jeremy's answer. He says he never understood why Trinity denies Cypher's phone and tells Morpheus they'll be back to track it. He said, I thought for a long time it was indicating that she knew he had turned evil, but it's actually just that his phone was the last one used to track her way back in the opening scene of the movie. They tracked it once, so she knows they can do it again, and that's an interesting one for sure.
Mm-hmm.
Going over to the chat, let's see. Slab says, Nega Scott in Scott Pilgrim, the reason he was so nice to regular Scott was because he was the inverse of regular Scott, who was a dick. Yeah, that's a really good one, actually, to think about, you know, because we always look at our our main character as the good guy, even though, God, clearly Scott is a dick in that movie. He so much is. Let's see. Any more? Flyboy says, I don't know if it was five viewings, but it did take a few times through to see Travolta walking past Tim Roth and Amanda Plummer at the beginning of Pulp Fiction. Yeah. Josh says, the Twin Pine / Lone Pine Mall joke in Back to the Future took me until like 1990 to notice. And I watched that movie millions of times as a kid, and I did not notice that for the longest time as well. Castroff says, I recently watched Prince of Egypt and realized that there are scenes besides the hieroglyph dream that are rendered partially in 3D. Okay, I guess we got to time for one more. Who is the director that is best at acting? They have to be a director first and most, so no Rob Reiner or Ben Stiller.
I'm going to go with Scorsese here. I like when he shows up and stuff, and Quiz Show is the one that I would go to first. I think he's great in that role. I think he's perfect as the executive, and there's something about the way he talks and the way he speaks that is distinctive and interesting to me.
Yeah.
So I would go with Scorsese, despite the actual answer probably being Werner Herzog. That's probably the actual answer.
He is. Yeah. I mean, he actually had people. I think he was an in-demand actor, in fact. Uh-huh. That's how good he was. I like Scorsese, too. He's terrifying in Taxi Driver as well, in that brief scene that he's in. That's a terrifying person. That movie does such a good job of, like, you know, of, like, not only are the people that De Niro runs into dangerous, but everybody out there is dangerous. And like, somebody in the back of your cab could just as easily be, you know, the guy that you need to, you know, I don't know. It's just, it's kind of a fascinating performance. I think Spike Lee fits this bill. Now, you don't see much of Spike Lee outside of his own movies, but I love him in Do the Right Thing. I think he's great in that. And of course he's saying his own dialogue, so therefore he knows exactly how that should go and how he wants to present it. But I really loved him in that. So I thought he was really good. And I'm probably missing somebody who's a really great actor who's we know as a director. But the real answer is Werner Herzog, like you said. So there you go. Over on the chat, Slab mentions Werner Herzog. Flyboy says Gary Marshall, so funny in Soap Dish. Now, that's an interesting one. Is Gary Marshall, would Gary Marshall be in that Ben Stiller, like the part of the question where they said they can't be an actor first or whatever? Because I feel like Gary Marshall was an actor first. Wasn't he on Happy Days? I think that was like one of the things that he started off, like one of the big things he was in, and he was an actor for the most part and then started directing. But
same reason you couldn't say Ron Howard, like the exact same reason.
It's the exact same reason. Yeah. Slab says Kevin Smith is great at being silent. Is that acting? I think he does pretty well in those things, actually. I think the being silent part is just, you know, is a funny shtick thing. But then when he actually has to talk in those things, I thought he was great in those anyways. He's pretty funny. I think he's even in stuff like that, the Die Hard movie, the Die Hard 4, which I can't think of the subtitle
Live Free or Die Hard.
Live Free or Die Hard. Yeah, I thought that was pretty good. So I mean, he's decent. Let's see. Don't. I guess someone mentions Tyler Perry. Probably not. I don't know Tyler Perry. Yeah, exactly. I was just about to get to that. Slab says Tyler Perry is good in non-Tyler Perry movies. Yeah, I agree. I think he's great in these other movies that he pops up in. And not to say, I mean, he's pretty good as Madea. I mean, I don't think those movies are great, but I think he's good as that character. And Slab does say Live Free or Die Hard on the Kevin Smith thing. And who's great in Gone Girl? I can't remember who's great in Gone Girl.
Is Tyler Perry in Gone Girl?
Tyler Perry was in Gone Girl. That's right. All right. Well, that's going to do it for this week. Once again, thank you, chat, for coming out and watching us talk about movies today. And next week is They Live from 1988, the John Carpenter film. Can't wait till we talk about that one. And that's going to do it for this time. We'll see you.
See you guys.
Bye. Be a part of the live show by being a member of the Sin Club at Patreon at patreon.com/cinemasins. Chat with us on the CinemaSins Discord at discord.gg/cinemasins or CinemaSins Twitter at CinemaSins, and email any comments or questions to recotopia@cinemasins.com. That's recotopia@cinemasins.com.
I might be able to pull that off during the 5-minute countdown. We'll see.
Huh.
I've done more during that 5 minutes before.
Yes, you have. I've seen you. Dirty, dirty dicer.
Wait a minute. I didn't know you could see my camera. How's the NFL season treating you so far?
So I'm a Titans fan, so mm-hmm. not so well.
Okay.
Titans were up 17-0 and managed to lose the game despite the opposing team not scoring an offensive touchdown. So that's... That's basic everyday Titans for you. If you're a Titans fan, you have to deal with stuff like Will Levis almost getting sacked and then deciding to throw a ball backhanded towards some nebulous part of the field that it's more than irony, I think. Well, it's probably just irony that I think about it. But when you are sitting in a bar watching something like that, and you have to tell your friends, Will Levis knows more about football than I ever will know.
Okay.
He has the capability to play football better than I ever will. But everybody in this room knows not to throw that pass, and yet he doesn't. I don't understand how that happens.
Yeah, it's you just have to chalk it up to the human brain just firing the wrong way.
It's what it is. That's what it comes down to. You think, especially when you're a young guy, mm-hmm. you think you can get out of any situation. And boy, wouldn't it be epic if this was a completed pass. And it's like...
Well, I mean, Kurt Warner had one where he was halfway to the ground and launched it, and it was a completed third down conversion, and everybody was like, I think, who is it, Collinsworth? It's always like, oh, man, he's the greatest quarterback of all time. And
sure.
He's like, this.
Well, that's the thing, right? Like, you have to be able to discern whether a completed pass even should have been thrown, because before that happened, before all the second half shenanigans happened in that Bears-Titans game,
mm-hmm.
he threw a touchdown pass that the tight end had to make an extraordinary play on. And, of course, we're all, like, happy because we got the touchdown and it's all that good and everything. And I turned to one of my friends and I said, I don't think he should have thrown the pass, but I'm glad for the touchdown. And that's exactly what happens later. You know, the statistics eventually catch up to you when you throw passes like that, because that should have been intercepted or something, but it just wasn't because the guy made a play on it. And sometimes it's what you got to do. You got to have a guy who can make a play, but sometimes, man, you don't have anybody in the area that can make a play.
Yeah.
So, like, yeah, whatever, man. It is the human brain. Who's to say what they would do in the same situation? There's three guys about to sack you, and you want to succeed and you want to show how good you are and all that. There's a lot of pressure. So, but still, I think, you know, once there's some maturity sets in, you realize, yeah, I just got to take the sack and hope our defense can make a stop. Cause they had been stopping them all day. They hadn't made any offensive, like there was no offensive touchdowns. Again, I'll repeat.
Yeah. The Lions were up by 14 or 17. I can't remember. Fairly late in the third, and ended up looking like they were going to lose it, and then managed mm-hmm. to kick a tying field goal, and then won the coin flip in overtime. Let's go.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And
luckily, though, nowadays, if you get that first possession, you have to score a touchdown to mm-hmm. end it. Otherwise, it keeps going. And that's sort of like, you know, the compromise now. Like, usually you should be able to stop a team from scoring a touchdown, so it's not as egregious as it used to be, where all they had to do was get in field goal range mm-hmm. and just win the game. So,
yeah. Yeah, it was a squeaker, but it's you know, again, it's weird being a Lions fan with a good team. And so it's weird feeling like they should win games, first of all, and then to feel what's this feeling of, oh, we're losing a game we should win, as opposed to, oh, we're throwing away a game that we should have lost anyway. But yeah, we've definitely got some weapons, so we'll see how far it goes.
Well, and they're like, they're one of those rare, close to complete teams in the salary cap era because they've got a good defense too. It's hard to get on both sides of the ball, have somebody have, like, you know, dominant ends on both sides. So,
I mean, Aiden Hutchinson, man, like, I watched him at Michigan and now watching him at for the Lions, it's so funny because it feels like every play somebody is either like lining up off sides to stop him or holding him or whatever. And the refs are like, we'll call like one out of five of them, but we can't call it every play, you know? And it's just like,
that would be silly. The NFL really needs to figure this penalty thing out because there is nothing more. This is a lot of people get upset at the glacial pace of baseball games. And I understand that there's very little action per second in a baseball game compared to most sports. But in football, you have a play, and then you have everybody goes and huddles up, and they have 25 seconds to go and like decide what their play is. And then they get up to the line, and then the play's about to happen, and then flags. And then you have to stop that up, and then there's another huddle, and there's another 25 seconds, and sometimes you get back-to-back penalties. And then there are some times where it's like, wow, what a great play. Ah, this guy over on the other end of the field, he was holding. That's a penalty. There's got to be something. We've got to eventually, like, we've got to eventually get rid of some penalties. Some have to go. Or they have to figure out something to just stop that, just stopping the momentum of the game.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a problem. It's one of the things I've really enjoyed, about kind of falling in love with soccer is that the halves are 45 minutes. There's no clock stoppage. They add time at the end for any kind of substitutions or, you know, like, so they'll like have a guy keeping track of how much extra time they should add at the end, and they'll add 5 minutes at the end. So you have a general idea, not only of how long the game's going to be, but it also creates this really nice flow to the game. And the substitutions are really limited so that, you know, it's not like there's people coming in all the time. Hockey can feel the same way too, where it's just like the game is always moving. And, you know, baseball has, you know, been the worst at this. That game is almost never moving. They've sped that up a little bit, thankfully, but football's kind of in the middle ground and kind of leaning towards less moving than not. Like, you could use your 30-second jump button pretty much every play and not miss anything, you know?
Yeah.
This something has to be fixed in that regard, it feels like.
They had the added emphasis this year on illegal formation. There are some penalties I just don't get. What is it? What is the advantage? A lot of times, like, you're calling a penalty on this. Illegal formation is one, like illegal shift. More than two people weren't set at the time of the ball. And like, how is that such a huge advantage? I don't get it. And they've emphasized it this year, so there's like more than ever illegal formations being called. And it was funny. I saw a thing on Blue Sky with somebody who I followed on there. They were playing that game in Brazil, and of course there was a lot of penalties and everything, and they were like, it's like, congratulations to NFL showing our superior football by having a penalty called every five plays or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah, it's wild. And there was, I remember there's stuff like that thing that happened in Dallas with Detroit last year where They said they made the wrong person eligible for receiver, even though they went up to, because they were trying to, like, you know, keep the other team from knowing, but let the refs know, and like announcing eligible receivers and stuff. Like, how can we not just simplify that stuff? Just like, you know, make it where somebody lines up, or make everybody eligible. Who, like, what are we doing? Open it up. Like, have fun. Yeah. I don't know.
They certainly wouldn't want to do everybody eligible, because then you're just like, that's a free-for-all on the field. It really does become rugby or whatever at that point.
Yeah, that's true. That's fair.